This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. Stay tuned to hear details of how to get a 10% discount and a free domain name.
Coming up today, rubber. Yes, we'll be talking about rubber at last. Plus, Brazil has passed an internet constitution that gives Brazilian citizens various rights online. And the father of modern rocketry has largely been written out of history because of his involvement in the occult and sexy orgies. So we've decided to write him back in this week, and for good reason. All that plus your feedback and how to get the best deal on drugs and guns online coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to darknet, shopping and negationism. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And that word, by the way, Liv gave me a real eyebrow raise just then. We're talking about historical revisionism, changing history, rewriting it. Negationism. There you go.
I've never heard that before.
I only heard it for the first time this week, to be fair. But I thought, this is its place. This is where I'm going to plant that word, and we're going to look up at the great tree that it produces.
We're learning later. Something. We haven't even got into the news yet.
I know. We're still in banter 60 seconds. Liv, thanks for coming back.
Thanks.
How's your dog?
My dog is amazing.
Good.
He's
performing tricks? Podcasting?
Not quite performing tricks. Sleeping a lot, pooping a lot, but we'll get there. Well, I will train him to be on social media soon.
Excellent. We're looking forward to that. We will come back to that, of course, at another point, because now it's time for the news. Katie, Brazil.
Yes,
Brazil indeed. Was in the news because of us this week.
It was, yes. Brazil is kind of leading the way, really, in some respects. So what it's done is passed a bill which is dubbed the Internet Constitution, and this was passed in the Senate yesterday, and it enshrines the right of Brazilian citizens to online privacy and equal access on the internet. So just to kind of go into the specifics a little bit, it places limits on metadata collection and usage. So companies can only kind of, they're going to have to abide by very strict guidelines to see what they can collect and use. It also ensures net neutrality, which stops telecom companies from charging more for streaming services, video streaming, and other things like video calls through services such as Skype.
Yeah, we've seen this being a big problem in the US.
Yeah, yeah.
Where companies like Netflix that basically take up about a third of the US's bandwidth at peak rates.
Exactly. Yeah.
Could get a bill from an ISP saying, pay us to access your network or your customers are going to have a poor experience.
Yeah, so this has been really heavily protested by the telecoms companies in Brazil, but actually they've managed to make sure that it stays in. One thing that they haven't managed to keep in was a clause that they had to remove about all global internet companies, so that includes things like Google and Facebook. But what they wanted to do was make sure that if they were collecting any user data about Brazilian users, that it was stored in data servers on Brazilian soil. And I think that it turned out that that was a bit impractical and it wasn't going to be possible. So they had to get rid of that clause. But they managed to keep another clause, which means that if those companies are involved, they have to, if they're involved in any kind of lawsuits or anything like that, they have to abide by Brazilian law, and any trials will have to take place in Brazilian courts.
Good.
So
this is an open web. I bet Mr. Tim Berners-Lee, or Sir Tim Berners-Lee, in fact, is probably quite pleased.
He is a big fan, actually.
Yeah,
so
he
said that the bill reflects the internet as it should be, an open, neutral and decentralized network in which users are the engine of collaboration and innovation. And he hopes eventually that these kind of rights are going to be extended to all citizens of every country through some kind of digital rights charter.
I would call that a digital utopia. I don't think it's probably going to happen.
Probably not.
There is too many commercial pressures and lobbyists in various parts of the world who will stamp out anything that stamps on their ability to charge more for something you've already paid for.
And varying understandings of what constitutes human rights in different regimes.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes. But a good start, good for Brazil. Very I don't think we'll Brazil. See this any point in the future that's sort of drafted as a law like this.
No.
But it would be rather nice if we could. So yeah. Can we get on that, please?
Politicians.
Please. We know you listen. Liv, it's time for that much demanded, often refused, highly anticipated rubber section. Because shredded tyre remnants, bear with us people, are being used to reduce traffic noise. We
yes.
don't often get to talk about innovations in the rubber world.
No, we don't really talk about rubber much at all, but
no.
Here we go. You may or may not know that used tyres are quite a big problem in terms
not.
Of waste.
I had an idea.
Well, you've seen, you know, kind of old pictures of them being burnt and causing a huge amount of kind of pollution. But that we generate a lot of them every year. Lots of people drive. And I think there's something like 300 million of them go to waste each year in the US. And in Europe, 480,000 tonnes of used tyres are created each year. So it's a bit of an environmental challenge what to do with these tyres. Now, this week, I wrote a story about an environmental engineering professor called Magdi Abdelrahman.
Well done.
Who is looking for ways of using the ground up rubber from these tyres and mixing it into the asphalt to make improved road surfaces. And they're improved in a number of ways. They're more durable. They obviously use up waste that would otherwise be going to landfill, but crucially, they are quieter and so they reduce noise pollution.
I hadn't really known that loud roads was as large a problem as, say, loud cars or.
They're all contributing factors. But what is known is that noise pollution does actually lead to health problems. It's recognised by the World Health Organization. It can not only cause hearing damage, but high blood pressure and sleep disturbance. And it can even affect people's immune systems, according to various studies. So, you know, you might think, oh, it's a bit of noise, it's a bit annoying. It actually can cause health problems.
I just would have thought that surely that must be more of a fault of the engines and the cars rather than the roads. I mean, a road is basically silent if there's no engine on it.
Well, no, it's the sound of the wheels on those roads. So I think they can say that using this rubberized surfaces, they can reduce the noise from the roads by 25%,
wow.
Which is quite significant.
So the friction of the rubber on the rubber rather than straight onto the tarmac.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Roads that have used rubber in their surfaces have been used since the 1960s in the US, but it hasn't taken off at all in the UK. But what this researcher is trying to do is take a really scientific approach to analyse the best way of making these rubberized surfaces, using how to grind, you know, the rubber, what chemicals to use to mix the rubber with the asphalt or bitumen or whatever we call it over here, and to make the most efficient, most long-lasting surfaces, which are the quietest and the easiest to manufacture. He also needs to check that, you know, when these materials are combined, they don't leak chemicals into the earth, because obviously that's a problem if it gets into the water supply.
So is there any chance that these roads will come to the UK? Because they sound like, you know, presuming that they're not leaking chemicals, that they're a pretty good idea.
Yes, they are a good idea. And there has been a trial in Scotland that started either this year or last year over a kind of a small section of road. I think it's the A90 near Dundee. But it's not being used more widely, and it really should be. And perhaps if this researcher manages to kind of nail the process of making these roads, it might spread a bit further over in the UK. But the problem with the UK is apparently there's no government support and no established ways of manufacturing these surfaces at scale. So that would need to be addressed.
So it's basically the same problem as electric vehicles.
That yes.
It's just not supported and it's not widespread enough to become good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're a cyclist, Liv.
Yeah.
Would rubber roads make things easier for you?
I tell you what, some of the roads in London are an absolute minefield of potholes.
Not literally.
Not literally, no, that would be awkward. No, they are, you know, riddled with potholes, which makes for quite an uncomfortable ride on the lady bits.
Yeah.
Probably the gentleman bits too, yeah. I imagine.
I was going to say, you know, I use more advanced forms of transport, like, you know, cars and trains and things like that.
Yeah.
So I don't suffer from this problem. Just strikes, delays,
yeah.
Cramped conditions.
You're sounding very proud of yourself there.
Miasma. Oh, you're kidding. I know exactly who the strikes next week are going to affect. Hey, it's not you two.
No.
On cyclists.
Well, I'm not a cyclist. No, but I tend to get slightly more primitive forms of transport. Well, Nate would say so, because I tend to get lots of buses.
Mm. Buses are punishment, let's be honest. They are punishing. Okay, well, facetious comments aside, that sounds really interesting, and I welcome a future of rubber roads. I think that in the past, I always found that going rollerblading on rubberized surfaces was always really quite nice.
Yeah.
We used to do roller disco. There was always like rubber bits and things. Yeah.
And I think if you've ever been to a playground, like a kid's playground, you sometimes feel those rubber surfaces, and they suddenly feel springy and
don't
nice
they?
And bouncy under feet.
Yeah.
Let's bring that to the road.
Let's bring that.
As a runner as well, I like to think, I mean, running on tarmac is really bad for your knees.
Mm.
And I like to think that it would make me more springy as a road runner too.
Great. Well, I for one welcome our future rubber roads. But let us know, are you looking forward to rubber roadage? podcast@wired.co.uk. Well, the dark web just got a little less dark with the launch of a new search engine that lets you easily find illicit drugs and other contraband on the interwebs. Now, this is called Grams, G-R-A-M-S, and it launched last week and is patterned a bit after Google. Looks quite a lot like Google's classic-look search engine. Plus, it's accessible only through the Tor anonymizing web browser. But, and here's the interesting bit, it fills a niche for anyone who wants quick access to sites like those that sell drugs and guns and stolen credit card numbers, counterfeit cash, fake IDs, and basically websites that previously could only be found by users who knew the exact and usually quite complicated address for the website. Now, the anonymous creator of this website, Grams, talked to Wired in a secret chat because he wants to be anonymous, and he said that he wanted, quote, to make it easy for people to find things they wanted on the darknet and figure out who was a trustworthy vendor. Now, I find that to be a very interesting comment. Who is a trustworthy vendor of stolen credit card details? I mean, who provides quality stolen crack?
And who decides that?
Exactly.
Well,
actually, that is one of the interesting things that I've got down here. I'm just going to jump ahead a little bit. But there are plans for advertising a la Google AdWords, basically in the sense that you can see who or which people get high-rated reviews and gets marked as providing quality merchandise, mm-hmm. and they can get promoted on this search engine. So you know that if, Liv, you're looking for your next crack fix, you know, because of kind of like a reputation management system, that's, you know, dodgy Merc69 provides fantastic crack cocaine.
That's great. So kind of like TripAdvisor or Yelp, I guess.
It's Yelp for guns, basically.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So now I know where to get my crack from.
Because, you know, before it was such a mystery for novices like us to navigate the dark web, but now we've got access to all of it. Hooray.
Exactly. But what it does is it works kind of like an old classic search engine that lets you, in one search the databases of many other sites. And these include Silk Road 2, which is very interesting given that it followed up from Silk Road that was shut down last year. And there are other sites as well, apparently called Agora, never heard of it, Black Bank, never heard of that, Cloud9, have heard of that one, Evolution, Nice Guy, Pandora, The Pirate Market, those sorts of places. And they make their APIs available to this service so their listings can be fed into other applications, or in this case another search engine. This is a really interesting idea. I mean, I don't have a need to buy crack cocaine or guns, but a lot of people do, and this is an enterprising way of I don't know, making that easier, I guess.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I find quite interesting is that I do wonder whether, because the guy who's, or woman, we don't really know, who's operating this, quite brave, let's be honest. It's not exactly an easy market to break into, I do sort of wonder, this is my little theory, whether there's a kind of two steps of deniability introduced by coming up with this sort of search engines for illicit search engines, which is the sites like Silk Road 2, they're not themselves selling products, it's people listing products.
So it's a platform.
It's a platform, and so that's one stage removed from culpability, if you like, although let's be honest, not really. This is a second stage that he could say, or she could say, well, I'm just letting you access these sites to let you access these people, you know, it's not my problem. It's the old BitTorrent website hosting defense, but on a second tier. Which I don't know, it makes it legally a very, very interesting one to watch and see how it develops. So we're not going to give out the address, but you can find a link on wired.co.uk. Obviously it's probably not a great idea to use it. But if you are curious, we do have the story and the backstory there. Katie.
Yes.
Lift me up. Really quickly. In fact, lift me up precisely 95 stories in 43 seconds.
Well, I can't do it, but I know a thing that can.
That's a very defeatist attitude. Go on.
Sorry, you're right. I should at least give it a go first.
Try.
So basically, Hitachi, the Japanese company, which is actually famous for building really fast lifts, has built the world's fastest lift, or elevator if you're in America. This new ultra high speed lift will travel 440 meters between the first floor and the 95th floor of the Guangzhou CTF Finance Center, I don't know if I've said that right, in China, in a mere 43 seconds. Now, this center is a multi-purpose skyscraper that's due to open in 2016. And altogether, it's going to have 95 lifts in the tower, which seems like a remarkable number of lifts. It's like one lift per floor, basically, it works out as.
This lift is going to move at 72 kilometres per hour. That's 1,200 metres a minute.
Yes.
That is fast. I'm curious, how does a lift that big not vibrate its occupants to death? Because I've been in some very fast but quite rattly lifts before now, and they scare the waste out of me.
Yeah,
frankly.
I mean, I get a bit nervous even kind of going in sort of smaller lifts because of the space and sometimes the speed. But apparently Hitachi has developed some special technology that will prevent lateral vibration. That's the side-to-side shaking that you feel.
Is that what it's called?
Yes, lateral vibration.
I didn't know that. Lateral vibration.
Yeah.
God, we're just learning words left, right, and centre, aren't we today?
And it will also prevent popping ears. So that kind of feeling you get when you go up in an aeroplane.
Or to the Peak District this weekend.
I mean, I also get this when I go just through a tunnel on the train. But apparently it's particularly bad with vertical movement.
I bet.
Yeah. So, and at high speed. But yeah, so Hitachi have created a proprietary air pressure adjustment system that will change the air pressure inside the lift when it's travelling at high speed.
I reckon Hitachi must be the hot contender for building a lift to the moon.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be amazing? This is getting there. I mean, it's still going to take you a while, let's be honest. It's about 300,000 kilometres away. But still...
Yeah.
It's a good start.
Yeah. I mean, it does kind of veer into sort of science fiction or something like Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, or, you know, some kind of... It's almost... If you kind of think about the speed that it's travelling at, that almost seems impossible. I can't really get my mind around it. Do you think you would want to experience moving in a lift at that speed?
No.
No. I think your stomach would lurch. Whether or not they've done the pressure to help your ears feel okay on the journey, you'll get that horrible... Going down, you can imagine your stomach lurching in a horrible fashion.
I just don't really like lifts very much.
No.
You know, I've never been a lift fan particularly, but they are convenient. Well, let us know what you think. Would you want to travel in a 72 kilometre an hour lift vertically? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. In fact, also, what's your favourite lift in the world that you've ever been into? Mine was in a recent trip to Sweden, in Stockholm, where the lift was one of those that had like a metal cage that you had to shut, and it didn't really have sides, it just carried you up the centre of the building. It was such a good lift, I took a video of myself walking into the lift, closing the door, and going up in the lift. It was very classy. I felt like I was in some sort of Wes Anderson movie.
I can't think whether I've got a favourite lift or not, but... Also within this building, they're going to have some lifts which are double-decker lifts.
Wow.
And that really appeals to me. I'm not sure how they work exactly, but like I've just always been a fan of everything double-decker, trains, buses, lifts.
We are living in such a tremendously progressive time, aren't we? Well, still to come, the occultist father of rocketry being written out of history, and we're going to write him back in.
This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. The easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, responsive designs, and 24/7 customer support teams based in New York and Dublin mean you can create a beautifully designed website for as little as £5 a month. This includes a free domain name when you sign up for a year. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code WIRED to get 10% off and to show your support for Nate, Olivia, Liette and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team. No credit card is required to give the service a spin. Visit squarespace.com to support the show.
Welcome back. Discussion and debate segment one. Thank you, science. Liv, today, as recording, this is Wednesday, the 23rd of April, you wrote one of the best things I've ever read today about a man involved in the occult, in orgies, and he also managed to father rocketry.
Yes.
Wow. Wow, wow, we were.
Well, it depends on who you ask, actually. So,
I'm asking you.
Well, this is a man called Jack Parsons, who played a critical role in the formation of rocket science starting in the late 1930s. And he was instrumental in building the rockets that were eventually used in the space race. The problem is, he's not widely known at all. You've probably not even heard of him. And that's because he had a slightly colourful life. He believed in magic. He was involved in the early stages of Scientology, that kind of cray-cray religion that Tom Cruise is a member of. He took a lot of drugs. And as you mentioned, he had a very colourful sex life, hosting lots of orgies at his Pasadena mansion. Now, I spoke to his biographer, George Pendle, who actually speculated that he'd been written out of the history books because he was seen as a bit of an embarrassment to the conservative US establishment. And so I dug into his life a bit, and I thought I'd pick out a few interesting things about this man.
Yes.
Most of them came from speaking to his biographer, George Pendle. Sadly, Parsons passed away in his 30s, so we couldn't speak to him.
In his 30s, in the 1930s?
Oh, in his 30s, which were in the 1950s.
Ah, of course, okay.
Okay.
All right, so we've got five things, fascinating things about this guy that you learnt in your feature.
Yeah, so the first was, when he started work, rocketry was science fiction. You know, they did not exist. Parsons was fascinated about the idea of travelling into space, but at the time this was considered completely pie in the sky stuff. So when he was applying for funding in the late 1930s, he and his team had to really focus on more earthly applications for rockets. They had to talk about things like making planes take off from a much shorter runway, even though Parsons really wanted to get into space. And he had a research group at Caltech University that actually became the first government-funded rocketry research group in history.
Cool. Awesome, Liv. Point two, please.
Point two was that his research group was known as the Suicide Squad. Obviously, the experiments involved explosives and were very dangerous and messy. Now, Parsons was a very skilled chemist, but that didn't stop this research group from blowing loads of things up. And actually, this is why they got the name of the Suicide Squad at Caltech University. In fact, a quarter of one lot of funding that they received had to go towards repairing the damage to Caltech buildings. So they were eventually pushed out by other scientists and had to relocate some iron sheds in a canyon in the desert.
Wow.
And now those sheds eventually became the base for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but they were continually investigated by the FBI because obviously anyone with access to explosives and government clearance is a potential risk.
Yeah. Wow.
So just to be clear, although they blew up a lot of things and caused a lot of damage, they didn't actually blow up any people, as far as you know.
No, they didn't. Well, we'll come on to that.
Okay.
Parsons' demise may or may not have involved explosives. But
planting that little seed of doubt into our forest of answers there, Katie. Okay, well, point three. Now, this one has the headline Solid Fuel.
Yes.
Which I'm always fascinated by. I love things that are solid.
Yeah, well,
not,
this was...
I love fuel.
This was actually Parsons' key contribution, or one of his key contributions, in developing rocketry. This was critical for developing jet-assisted engines, and the key innovation was restricted burning solid rocket fuel that was stable enough to be stored indefinitely. Without this fuel, they would not have been able to create rocket engines. In the past, they had to use a powder which was combined with a liquid, and that was kind of messy and unstable, and it couldn't be stored for any length of time. But it was a version of Parsons fuel that was actually eventually used in NASA's space shuttle and in military ballistic missiles.
You know what? That rings a bell now I think about it. I was listening to an audiobook a couple of months ago about the history of Area 51 after some documents were declassified, and they had to develop a type of fuel that could be stored at room temperature, that could be burnt as fuel, but that also could be used in these high altitude jet planes in super high cold, freezing cold temperatures, or way sub-zero temperatures, that were so weird that they used to get new recruits to stand next to barrels of it, and they would drop a cigarette or a match into the top of it and to try and freak out the newbies.
Oh my God.
But the matches would just go out because they were designed not to combust at room temperature. Yeah. I wonder if he had any connection with that. The dates would sort of fit, maybe.
And he does sound a kind of... I want to say fun, but playful type of person.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
He does. Okay, interesting. What's point four then? Magic, or an interplay between magic and science / arts?
Yeah. So Parsons was obviously fascinated by science, but also had this intense interest in magic and the occult. He actually felt that some of the magic could be explained by quantum physics. So it was a kind of scientific, or at least, you know, pseudo-scientific explanation for some of the things that were taking place, or at least he thought was taking place. And as described in the intro, you know, he had some very kind of strange interest. The founder of Scientology, he hadn't actually founded it at that point, L. Ron Hubbard, moved into Parsons' lodge and ended up kind of stealing his girlfriend. Parsons then tried to use magic in bizarre rituals to conjure up a new partner, and he was actually convinced that he had succeeded. And when he met this woman called Marjorie Cameron, he felt like he'd managed to conjure up his perfect woman, and then ended up writing a whole load of poetry to her, which has actually been published in a book this year, which was kind of the reason why this was sort of the hook for the story in the first place.
Wow.
But I guess the point on this one is that nowadays we generally separate the arts and science, and I know magic isn't really either of these. It kind of, that was a sort of slightly odd interest as well, but the point is that Parsons really felt like he was like some of the scientists in the olden days, the kind of polymaths or Renaissance men such as Newton, who actually, you know, wrote about alchemy as well, and Galileo, who was a mathematician, an astronomer, a physicist and a philosopher, and then people like Aristotle, you know, would write poetry, theatre, music, as well as you know, writing about metaphysics and logic and ethics. And I think we have these quite siloed ideas of what scientists are these days, and I think he was one of the, perhaps one of the last kind of proper Renaissance men.
Interesting. That's a very interesting viewpoint. I always like conversations that intersect between things like magic and science, because they are indivisible depending on the year or the decade you look. Magnetism being a great example. Until we explained it, magnetism was magic.
Yeah,
and then we figured out how it worked.
And I think the idea is you need these kind of slightly out there people like Jack Parsons, who go beyond just incremental scientific advancements. They're going into kind of land that where people think they are a bit crazy, the idea of going into space. But having people with that creativity allows for larger leaps to be made, I think, in science. And you might not agree with some of his lifestyle choices, his drug consumption, but I think there are some interesting ideas around having that level of imagination, mind-bending imagination, and taking greater leaps in science.
I suppose it's a blessing that Elon Musk hasn't been described as a witch more often.
I know.
Because some of his ideas could be classed as pretty out there.
Yeah, and Steve Jobs, you know, famously talks about taking hallucinogenics, and this is something that Parsons was very keen on, apparently.
Interesting. Okay, well, we've got the fifth and final point about this man coming up, and this one is headlined just death.
Yeah.
He did die, so I suppose it's a given.
He died. It's a sad story. So having been so instrumental in the early stages of rocketry, he eventually ended up losing his clearance for working with government. This was partly because he had very liberal views. It was a time of war, of Cold War, where anyone remotely liberal was kind of somehow deemed a communist. And so he lost his clearance. And his biographer thinks that it's his non-scientific interests that were what pushed him out of NASA's history books. He ended up actually working on pyrotechnics in the film industry, which might sound quite cool now, but was a bit of a depressing step down for a man who'd been so heavily involved in creating these rockets. And then in 1952, he was 37, and he got a big order for a film just before he went on holiday. So he was in a rush to make these pyrotechnics. And supposedly he dropped something which caused an explosion, and this explosion gave him fatal injuries, and he died.
I'd read somewhere that he was assassinated.
Well, that is what conspiracy theorists say, but his biographer, who spoke to many, many people and you know, has really looked into this, believes his luck run out. He had a very hands-on, slightly not slapdash approach, but he was very comfortable with explosives. He got close and personal, perhaps, you know, putting cigarettes into vats, I don't know. But I think he lived a bit too close to the edge for too long and his time ran out.
Oh. Well, don't miss Liv's feature on wired.co.uk. You can find it by searching. I think Occultist Father will probably bring up the single article. I don't think we have many articles with that in the headline. No. Or Father of Rocketry. That will also pull this up. It is well worth a read and also worth just having a look at some of the images that Liv's got in this piece. So search Father of Rocketry or Occultist Father on wired.co.uk to find those. Last discussion segment before we jump into the feedback loop. This is Ride the Technosaurus. This week, we are riding the Technosaurus through a debate about Facebook, which may be struggling to get rid of its single app and replacing it with multiple apps. Now, Facebook is kind of trying its darndest to split its Everything in the Kitchen Sink site into a collection of more narrowly focused apps. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO, recently referred to this, quote, unbundling of the Big Blue app as a top priority. Now, we've seen that manifest itself quite a lot recently. Things like getting rid of messaging from the main Facebook app. That's going, by the way. Can you believe that? Mm. No more chat in your Facebook app because Facebook wants you to use its Messenger app. You may have noticed the irremovable banner in the app that says, hey, install this now without any option to get rid of the annoying message. Yeah. But that's going to happen. Then there's Paper, which is another recently launched app that's just the news feed, basically, for important info. I expect we'll see them for things like events. You can imagine like a Facebook calendar app. For photos, feels almost like a complete given at this point, particularly with it owning Instagram. And the question is there a benefit? Do we want all these separate disassociated Facebook apps or not? I, for one, am annoyed by change.
Yeah, see, I wouldn't mind having these apps as long as you could still use the main app in the way that you've become accustomed. So as you identify, the messaging app, if you're on the mobile app now and someone's sent you a message, you click on it and suddenly you have to download another app in order to read it. And I find that incredibly irritating from a user experience point of view. And I don't understand why they can't just keep that as a feature and just also have a separate app for people who wanted to use it.
It's probably just to stop forking developer time. It's harder to maintain two parallel platforms that ostensibly do the same thing. So separating it out allows more of a focus. But it's the user experience that's annoying there.
Yeah.
It means that you might be doing something in Facebook. You get a message come in. You have to leave that app, go into the next app to message them back, then go back into your previous app.
Yeah.
Like that's already happening and it's annoying. I tried Messenger. I made myself use it for a month. A month's usually long enough to get used to something and I got rid of it.
Yeah.
I was like, this is really annoying having to switch apps every time.
I think even with multitasking, as good as it is nowadays, it's still not making the experience bearable for most people, including myself.
Yeah.
And I actually think that it's really detrimental to Facebook to be able to have one experience of Facebook on a browser and not to be able to have a similar experience when you're using it on a mobile device.
Well, mobile experiences do tend to be tuned for the platforms
they're
created for.
They do. They tend to be, increasingly, we're seeing kind of adaptive frameworks, you know, that provide a similar experience across all platforms rather than having, you know, really different experiences in different areas. You know, I find that a lot of, you know, if you look at, say, the new BBC iPlayer, for example, like that app has been kind of designed so that it's responsive and that you'll have a similar experience, because once you kind of get used to that, you want to be able to move between devices really easily and seamlessly. And I think that this really fragments the whole experience of using Facebook.
Fragmentation is definitely the problem there. I mean, there are definitely benefits as well. You know, having very focused apps allows it to compete better with other very focused apps. It's no secret that Facebook missed the boat when it came to Twitter. And in a sense, as Twitter has become more Facebook-like over recent months, that Facebook can do something to now more better compete with Facebook. There's an alignment forming between those two companies in that as Facebook got more Twitter-like, or the newsfeed got more Twitter-like, and as Twitter got more Facebook-like, they're almost looking parallel in terms of their feature offering, and so having dedicated apps does help them compete there. But is there a benefit to the user? Does it not just get tedious and annoying to have five different Facebook apps. I mean, Facebook, in a sense, I mean, I've described it in the past as being like a meta web, kind of like AOL was in the 90s, where you had this platform and there's all these different things you could do on AOL without leaving the AOL world. It's very safe and gated. And Facebook is kind of like that. It's almost like Facebook wants to be, you know, it wants to be the kind of disconnected hive mind, if you like, that is powering lots and lots of different things. It doesn't want to be Facebook. Facebook is almost like a server providing access to all the different websites, if you like. And that's not necessarily a bad thing in the long run, but I don't know. Am I rambling?
No, I know what you mean. And I also, but I feel like it's tried different approaches in the past. So I know that what it wants to do basically is to make itself the center of your mobile experience. And, you know, the way that it's done that in the past, it's tried lots of different things. You know, there've been phones with Facebook buttons on them. There was the HTC First, which never saw, I think it was the first, it never saw the light of day, which was like the Facebook phone where your interface was all about Facebook. And the thing is, I think perhaps it's trying all these different approaches, and now it's trying to kind of fragment itself all over your phone so that all your different apps are Facebook related. But, you know, maybe people don't want that. I don't know.
Well, we are going to jump into the feedback loop, and we're going to start by talking about your opinions on Facebook's multiple app strategies. This is the feedback loop, the portion of the show where we hear from you. And we were, just before that lovely little jingle, talking about your opinions of Facebook splitting out its various apps. Katie, what have the Facebook fans been saying about Facebook?
They have been saying some very interesting, profound things about Facebook.
Let's hear the best three also.
Yes. So John Martins says, "The sole reason I started using Messenger as a separate app was purely down to the less than perfect performance of the Facebook app on my now ancient iPhone 4. Browsing the news feed alone isn't exactly a smooth affair, but dragging those little chat icons around was downright awful. Ideally, I'd have one app with everything included that didn't bog down my phone and freeze up every 20 seconds.
Okay, so what he actually wants is just a better Facebook app.
Yeah.
Or a better phone.
A better phone that can cope with the demands of the Facebook app a bit better. So
I have to say, I never got used to those little bubble things.
No.
I quite like those. Chat heads, they're called.
No. Yeah.
I quite like them. There's something quite reassuring about seeing four of your friends' bubbled faces and sort of flicking them away like some sort of weird, all-powerful, finger-enthused god.
Maybe Facebook could make that into a game.
Yeah,
it already is a game. That's interesting. It does the unwritten comment there is that the app is a bit bloated.
Yeah,
which is an issue.
David Jory says, "Do we use separate apps on the desktop for Facebook messages? There's no way to rid our screens of the chat icon there, so it's funny they don't want the app to have anything to do with chat. If I'm going to close the app to message, I'll use a different app, but then maybe they're making space for something else, ...
But you know what? You can use Facebook outside of that, because it's powered by Jabber, which means you can just add Facebook to your IM client, or I use it on messages on my Mac. You can just add it to that, and things like ADM supports Facebook chat. Anything that supports the Jabber protocol supports Facebook, so you don't need to have the Facebook window open even to have Facebook conversations. All your friends show is online IM contacts.
Yeah,
so you can do that.
But I think that again shows that people prefer to have everything aggregated in one place rather than have it fragmented into completely different sections on their phones.
Well, let's hear one more.
Thomas Foster says, "I actually liked the splitting out of Messenger. It made sense. It's a talky app, not a content one. It gives me focus, and the lovely overlay bubbles are brilliant, though there is no technical reason why that couldn't be part of the main app. My problem comes when I start to use both and they crosstalk because the integration now relies on the OS. Recently, the connection broke, so clicking on a contact in the active friends side didn't open the Messenger app, and in fact freezes the main app until I hit the back button. If this was one app, it wouldn't be an issue. I don't see the purpose of splitting out paper. Surely that app is just what the primary Facebook app is about, or am I missing something?
Yeah.
Also, camera. I share quick pictures on Facebook. I don't need a whole app for that."
Interesting.
Which I think is a really good point.
I agree.
I don't think a Facebook camera app is something that I would want or use.
Okay, well, let us know what you think about this topic. Separate apps for Facebook apps. What is your opinion? It's the burning issue. podcast@wired.co.uk. Well, last up in the feedback loop, not to do with Facebook, Richard Gunther has written in, hasn't he, Katie?
He has. He says, greetings to Nate and the amazing Wired UK podcast team. I had a follow-up question after your segment on the change in UK copyright law. In the US, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is believed to trump fair use, and there hasn't really been enough precedent established to challenge that. Is there any similar law in the UK that might otherwise make the act of circumventing digital copy protection illegal? Perhaps still in conflict with the pending June the 1st changes? For example, if you knew how to copy a Blu-ray disc to format shift a movie you own, will that now be completely legal? In the US, backing up copy-protected DVDs and Blu-ray discs that you own is still a violation of the Act.
Yep. Really good question. And this relates to a topic we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where the UK copyright law is effectively being changed to allow you to format shift stuff. I'm going to answer these backwards, I think. Kate Liv probably has the same answers as me here. Basically, yes, you will be allowed to copy a Blu-ray disc to format shift a movie you own from the 1st of June. It will be legal. It does also mean that if the company operating the Blu-ray disc copy protection makes it too hard to break that copy protection for your own personal and private use, non-commercial, then you can actually effectively take them to court, if I remember our conversation right, Liv? Is that right? I think
that is right. I wonder how it works internationally, though. I think there might
It doesn't. I mean, Richard was also asking whether because there's fair use in the US, we don't have fair use.
Well, the exceptions introduced on June the 1st will also allow for something like fair use. They actually use the terminology fair use in it, so you will be able to use stuff to comment on it, criticize, and they've kind of made clearer guidelines about what constitutes fair use versus, you know, ripping something off.
Yeah. So I hope that answers your question, Richard. Basically, if you want to copy your Blu-rays, come to the UK from the 1st of June. We can be a new destination for legally ripping stuff. You know, if you want to get high, go to Amsterdam. If you want to rip your legally owned DVDs that you paid for, come to the UK.
What if you bought them abroad? Does it still apply?
You still own them, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you still own them. That would be fine. Let us know any of your questions, though, about today's topics or any other topics. Do you want to know what colour Liv's dog is? Do you not want to know what Katie's thinking right now? Or do you want to hear more of my views on why many pagans have it right about quantum mechanics? podcast@wired.co.uk. I think that's going to wrap it up for this week. Liv, Katie, anything else to add? No?
No.
No.
Good. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
Feeling sexy, feeling ready. Sorry.